Group meeting Sunday, 20th September 1987. So now, heaven endures constant. I'm using the word heaven here in place of transcendence. Earth changes her garb whensoever heaven's light enfolds her. Heaven's light is invisible. The earth, which refracts the unknown light and drapes herself in flashing colors for our soul's delight. The communion is timeless and measureless. In its heavenly state, it is eternally silent. Now, communion, which we speak of in this book, refers to the supreme depth of consciousness which a human being can possibly reach. And when I say a human being, I'm including all the great spiritual teachers, the founders of the religions, and so on. In the state of pure communion, one is completely silent. And that silence means not merely the silence of the tongue, it means the silence of the brain. The flow of talk by the brain, which happens all through the day, as well as the night without our knowing it, apart from pure dreamless slumber, that when that stops, then there is the real silence. And this communion, of course, therefore, is timeless, because one's consciousness of time disappears. And it is measureless. It is not a case of a communion of one being, an identifiable entity, with God or the totality or the absolute or whatever you like to call it. It is not treating the absolute or God as an other. The otherness completely disappears out of consciousness in the supreme communion. And that is something which is specific, I think, to Eastern mysticism, not to Western mysticism, insofar as it is dominated by Christian theology. Because Christian theology does not allow that sort of communion for the mortal creature. In its heavenly state, it is eternally silent. When earth nestles in heaven, man sings of the silence. That is, when man returns back to his ordinary everyday state of consciousness, which is due to the functioning of his senses and all the sense impressions which are synthesized into meaningless patterns of meaningful patterns of thought by the brain. So this song sings of the silence. It's a song of creation, and creation itself, like heaven, is constant, invisible, unknown. This is something which the brain will never know. You can experience it, you can become aware of it in a transcendent way, but it is something which the brain will not translate into concepts and words. If it does, it generally is inadequate. It's an inadequate presentation, and as often as not, it is a misrepresentation. Now, creation must be distinguished from procreation. We human beings talk about so-and-so being a creative genius, and this, that, and the other, scientist, philosopher, artist, whoever he is. But all that in science, philosophy, art, and so forth, is cultural procreation. The difference is this. Procreation is true to type. An acorn will grow only into an oak. A mosquito can't give birth to an elephant, and so on. All this is procreation. It's true to type. What is true creation is something utterly new, utterly unknown. It never was, but will continue to be. This is something which is not properly presented, I think, by any of the mystics of the world. This difference between creation and procreation. Whatever the living human being produces is either biological procreation or cultural procreation. It's true to type. If you write a sonnet, well, it's true to type, isn't it? 14 lines and all the rest of it. If you write a play, 3 acts or 5 acts or whatever they are, and it's all true to type. It matters not when a man lived. 1,000 ages ago, if heaven touched him, that is, if transcendence touched him, he stood in silent wonder. And afterward, perhaps he made a sound. I'm referring to people in bygone days, many, many millennia ago. They made a sound. That sound was a call for whoso cared heavenward. Or perhaps he saw a bird or a beast, a rock or a tree. His first sense impression became the sign of the holy. And I think that is how totems and totemism arose. The first sense impression after such an experience of transcendence became the sign of the holy. This was the message. You know how in the Ring of the Nibelungen, Wotan sends the 2 ravens, doesn't he? It's the 2 ravens, isn't it? Am I right or am I wrong? Correct me. They are the messengers, you see. In Greek mythology, we have Hermes as the messenger of the gods. It matters not... Yes, we have finished that. The tides of time flowed on. Heaven endures constant, but earth grew older and richer in color. Notice I use the present tense for heaven. Heaven endures constant. Because that which belongs to eternity is ever new. It's ageless. But earth grew older and richer in color. And man, her child, grown to power of speech, was drawn more often to more intimate communion. The benediction of heaven is the same 100 ages ago as it is 1,000 ages ago. It is ever the same. Only earth and man had changed and grown. Prajapati Parameshtin sings his song of creation. Now, do note this, that in the old days in India, possibly in China, I don't know about China, in this case. But in India, the perfected holy ones adopted a pseudonym. They never gave their own name. You know, to this day, the Swamis, for instance, they are so-and-so Nanda, Ananda, you see. Swami Ganananda or Vishwananda or something like that. They give up the old name because the old name represents the existential mortal. In becoming the true Swami, because of course it's questionable how many ever do, in becoming the true Swami, one has become a true Brahman. And the Vajrasuchi Upanishad gives you the correct definition of a true Brahman. It says outright that whatever be the caste in which you are born, your social heritage, you see, whatever your caste may be, if you realize Brahman, then you are a Brahmin. And that is the true meaning of Brahmin. But of course, that was a few thousand years ago. How long it remained as such, I don't know. But in modern times, the Brahmins as a caste are just a particular social group, that's all. Now, Prajapati means Lord of Creatures. Parameshthin means the Supreme Being. What a pseudonym to adopt. Lord of Creatures, Supreme Being. We in modern times, particularly in the West, would say, what extraordinary conceit these people must have had. But it was no conceit. The Western world, by and large, is Christian. Jesus said, I and the Father are one. So now, is that conceit? Is it fact? Is it truth? I would definitely say it is truth. Because any human being who has realized to the full the whole meaning of humanness has transcended all the flaws and difficulties of the subhuman state. The human race, as it is called, consists almost entirely of subhuman beings. I'm not using the word pejoratively. Subhuman simply meaning that we are still progressing on the way to becoming perfect humans. And as I've explained several times in past meetings, the word human, its true meaning, its literal meaning in fact, is blissful creator. Now, isn't that how we describe God? All the God conceptions which have been put forward by human beings in all the great religions are produced out of the brains of human beings. And they represent, to put it in the nicest way, they represent the aspiration of humanity towards its fulfillment. In fulfillment, a human becomes a God, as we call it. You know how in the golden verses of Pythagoras, one of the last verses states that he who has gone beyond the body implying all that attaches to mortality, its troubles, its defects, and so forth. He who has gone beyond the body reaches the supreme ether and becomes an immortal God. That's in the golden verses of Pythagoras. So, Prajapati Parameshthin is Lord of Creatures, Supreme Being. Nice chap. Sings his song of creation. Now, these are the verses. Then was not non-existent, nor existent. There was no realm of air, no sky beyond it. What covered it in, and where, and what gave shelter? Let's start with the first line, the very first word, then. Now, we know the meaning of then refers to something temporal. This, that, and the other was the case, then that happened, and so forth. We use it in that sense. But when the perfected holy ones used the word then, they referred to the fact of that timeless communion in which they were. That is how you have to interpret the word then in the old Vedic Upanishadic writings. Then was not non-existent nor existent. Existent, of course, we understand, it's that which is manifest, the manifested world, including us. What is the non-existent? Because he uses the non-existent as a noun, as an actuality. I, the existential being, existing now here, am existent. When this psychophysical organism dies, it becomes the non-existent. But when it becomes the non-existent, every aspect which may refer to an identifiable entity is completely gone. Think, when you dream, for instance, are you aware what happens to your I am I consciousness? In dreamless slumber particularly, that I am I consciousness has absolutely vanished. So too, the existent, when it comes to its ending, mortally, it becomes the non-existent. But the non-existent is immortal. It is the totality. Now, see, it isn't easy to grasp this. Try and follow it. I'll try to explain it properly. The existent is present in millions and millions, countless millions. The non-existent is one only. Isn't that so? It's just one only. The existent has become the one only. But it hasn't become the one only because it has come to its fulfillment in the complete sense, fulfilled the purposes of its existence, but simply because death does that. The ending of the psychophysical organism means that that psychophysical organism is done with now. And all that composed the psychophysical organism, body, feeling, thought, body, soul, mind, spirit, etc., whatever you like to call it, is all in that one. The nondescript one. So, when he says, then was not non-existent nor existent, he is referring to those two states. The one which we are conscious of here whilst we are alive, and the other of which we are unconscious. All the elements go back to their origin. And the origin is an absolute one only, a unitary whole, which by self-limitation becomes the total manifested, consisting of innumerable particulars. It's very difficult for the brain to really to grasp this. It took me over 70 years to begin to grasp it. That's why I chatter about it now. Was water there? Wait a minute. There was no realm of air. Now, of course, these translations made by Christian European scholars are very good translations on the whole, but they miss the symbolism. Air, the word in the Vedic text is Vayu. Now, Vayu is, of course, materially air, wind. Those two words are the translation of Vayu. But Vayu also represents the spirit, the soul, that is Vayu, and it should be understood here as that. No sky beyond it. Sky I can't explain, I don't know. What covered in and where, and what gave shelter? Was water there? Unfathomed depth of water. When they use the word for water, they refer essentially to life, life energy. We talk of the waters of life. Death was not then, because in that state of supreme communion which the Holy One enters into, he knows no such thing as death. Death is the uttermost transformation of that which is manifest. It's the ending of the manifest. It's the entry into the unmanifest. Nor was there aught immortal. Now that I don't understand, because the Holy One in this state of supreme communion is actually experiencing the immortal. Immortality is not after death or anything like that. Immortality is experienced here and now, whilst you are alive in the body. No sign was there, the days and nights divider. Then he says, that one thing, breathless, breathed by its own nature. The Sanskrit words are tad ekam, that one. Tad is that and ekam is one. That one stands for the unitary whole as such. And then of course he has to use material similes, breathed by its own nature. The word for breath is prana. Prana also means life, and it stands both for life in the body as we know it, and it also stands for life eternal, as you experience it in the Supreme Communion. Apart from it was nothing whatsoever, the unitary whole out of which the totality emerges. Because that unitary whole contains within it in potentiality everything that ultimately becomes manifest. The one becomes the many, the countless many, and the countless many return back to the one. Darkness there was. Now it's very interesting. You find, for instance, in the Kabbalistic teachings, the beginning is darkness. Ein Sof. It's the divine dark. The term divine dark was used by one of the great Christian mystics. Do you remember who? I think the divine dark was used by Tauler. He was a contemporary of Dante and St. Thomas Aquinas. It was a wonderful era, that latter part of the 12th and the early 13th century. The most remarkable era in the Christian world. At first concealed in darkness, this all was indiscriminated chaos. This all means the total manifested world, the universe, was indiscriminated chaos. How on earth did those writers manage to speak so truly? Because the first thing that happens with the Big Bang is a tremendous chaos. They are not chemical elements. They are subatomic particles. And they are all positively, some are positively, the others are negatively charged. And the positive and negatively charged particles rushed together, and there was an enormous release of energy and the destruction of the subatomic particles as such. And the extraordinary thing science has now discovered is that these subatomic particles, when they destroy themselves like that, release so much energy, and the almost impossible thing, give rise to other particles which are practically of the same size and quality. It's a miracle, isn't it? But there we are, these things happen. Darkness there was indiscriminate chaos. All that existed then was void and formless. One is reminded of Genesis chapter 1, and the earth was void and formless. Earth signifying manifestation. Of course, scholars and theologians, priests and prelates mostly confine earth to the planet earth. But it's not just the planet Earth. It stands for all manifestation. By the great power of warmth was born that unit. Now, I disagree with that translation there. You know, I've disagreed with a good many translations of the scriptures in the past. The word warmth, the word in Sanskrit is tapas. Now, tapas does mean warm. Tap is warmth, yes. But tapas also means attentiveness. That concentrated attentiveness in profound meditation. That is tapas. Consider, for instance, how the Hindus presented the concept of Brahman, when they made Brahman into a concept. The absolute all, the origin of all creation and so forth, is described as Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means being, it also means truth, it also means reality. You see? And Western scholars, and I think Eastern scholars too, have tended to translate those wonderful lines in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Asato ma sadgamaya, tamasoho ma jyotirgamaya, and so on. Asato ma sadgamaya, they have translated it as, from the unreal, lead me to the real. From non-being, lead me to being. You can translate it that way also. In the Chandogya Upanishad, when Uddalaka Aruni teaches his son Svetaketu, he says, how could the universe come out of non-being? No, it comes out of being. Rather interesting, they used to argue with each other about these things. So tapas is best, now tapas is related to the word chit. Chit means attention, thought, yes, but it also, I would also translate it as that kind of attention which is pure attentiveness. Look, supposing we talk in theistic terms. The theistic religions say God created the universe. The usefulness of the word God is that it is a monosyllable. It's very easy to pronounce it. God created the universe. All right. But God never withdraws his attention from the universe. When people ask, why is there evil, how is there evil, and so forth, and they say, why did not God prevent evil or get rid of evil? God attends to the whole universe. Never for a moment does he withdraw his attention from the universe. He does not reject anything that has been brought into being. There is no cosmic dustbin in which we collect the rejects of the universe and chuck them in there. There's no such thing. Everything undergoes a transformation. This is a point which I'm surprised the majority of theologians and philosophers have completely missed out. They've never thought about it. We have recognized, because science has, for one thing, compelled us to recognize, that the whole universe is a constantly changing thing, constant change. But what kind of change? It is a change which is a process of transformation in such a manner that each particular manifested thing fulfills to the uttermost its particular uniqueness and its particular purpose in the scheme of things. It's that sort of change. So, as long as God maintains his attention upon the whole universe, the universe continues to be. And in this connection, there is a very interesting statement in the Zarathustrian scriptures. It's called, this particular scripture is not an original writing by Zarathustra or teaching by him. It is called the Vandidad. That's the shortened form of Vidaevo Datem, which means what is done against the demons. What is done against the demons. And in that there is one verse which states that Ahura Mazda, which is the Zarathustrian word for God, the Supreme Being, Ahura Mazda spoke the creative word. In Judaism we have the Ma'amar, and in St. John's Gospel we have the word. In the beginning was the word, the creative word, which really means the primordial creative energy. That is the word. And in the Trismegistic writings, it is declared that that word is the meaning of the term Logos, the Son of God. That is the real Son of God, that creative word. Now, Ahura Mazda not only pronounces the Ahuna Vairya, the creative word, but he keeps repeating it constantly, and it is declared that if everything in the material universe were never to cease from repeating the creative word, which means utilizing the creative energy, if it could, of course, that is, you see, then the material universe would continue to be immortal forever and ever. Then the next verse states, owing to a pause in the repetition of the creative word, evil came into being. Now what an extraordinary thing that is. think of ourselves, when our minds are unoccupied with what is really good and so forth, how easy it is for the mind to slip into, well, we don't speak of such things. You see what I mean? Evil creeps in when the attention is withdrawn or is dormant as far as the positive good is concerned. So, by that great power of attention was born that unit, the world. Thereafter rose desire in the beginning. Now the word used there in the Sanskrit is kama, K-A-M-A. Don't mix it up with karma, K-A-R-M-A. Kama. Kama is the Greek eros. Now, our word erotic is derived from the Greek eros. But one aspect of eros is usually forgotten or not attended to. Eros is really the bestower of immortality upon all the gods. You study your Greek pantheon carefully, Greek mythology, and you'll find Eros is the bestower of immortality upon all the gods. That aspect of love, which we experience as erotic love, and which the animal world as a whole experiences, in its completely transmuted state, is the creative energy which is transcendent love. And that also is Eros. You see? In the psychophysical organism, which has evolved out of the animal kingdom, it inherits the animal tendencies. And therefore, the sort of karma we experience and feel is this erotic karma, to start with, but it can be completely transmuted into something which is truly creative. When people really understand how to utilize it in the right way, parents will be able to create Christs and Buddhas as their children. So thereafter arose karma in the beginning. I'll use his word. Desire, the primal seed and germ of spirit. And what is spirit but the creative power? Sages who searched with their heart's thought discovered the existence kinship in the non-existent. What is heart's thought? The word used, of course, there is hridaya. Now, hridaya has two meanings, at least. It refers to the physical heart, and it also means heart in the sense in which, in the English language, we say that the heart of the matter is so-and-so. See? It's that heart which is in us, this capacity to see truth and to realize truth, searched with their heart's thought, and discovered the existence kinship in the non-existent. That is to say, the kinship of the manifested being, the psychophysical organism, with the unmanifest. The multitude related to the one total unity. Then come lines which I really don't know. All these years I've never been able to understand this. Transversely was their severing line extended. What is this severing line? I don't know. What was above it then, and what below it? And the answer given is, there were begetters, there were mighty forces, free action here, and energy up yonder. But if you look at the words above and below, in Genesis we have the statement, the waters above the firmament and the waters below the firmament. I don't know what this transversely the severing line was extended. The two waters which are separated in Genesis. Who verily knows, and who can here declare it, whence it was born, and whence comes this creation? The gods are later than this world's production. Who knows then whence it first came into being? Now, this is an extremely interesting statement. The gods are later than this world's production. This world, planet Earth, and the universe generally, has given rise to us human beings. We have made the gods in all the pantheons. Human beings are wise, foolish, greedy, generous, etc., etc., etc. You see? I love, therefore I project that out of my brain and ascribe it to a supreme being who is all love. I am wise in some ways and I project that into a supreme being. I postulate this supreme being. These are the gods of creation. It is I who am Zeus and Hera, Athena and Apollo and Hermes and the whole zing-bang lot of them. You see? That is the fact of the matter. The gods of all the different pantheons are the creation of man. Now, they are a very valuable creation because they represent man's aspiration towards perfect fulfillment. They also represent man's realization that the evil in him, what is troublesome in him, is also a tremendous power to deal with. And this is where an Upanishad like the Brihadaranyaka is so very, very valuable. In the first chapter, the third section, verses 1 to 21, I think. You look it up. You see, 1, 3, 1 to 21. Prajapati, the lord of creatures, had twofold offspring, the Suras and the Asuras, the demons and the gods. And the demons preceded the gods. Possibly, in some way or other, those holy ones of 2,000 and 3,000 years ago were aware of the evolutionary process. They may have been aware of the evolutionary process. I don't know. And what comes first in the early stage is the savage, the destroyer, the one who is fearful, who is determined to dominate everybody else, and so forth and so forth. So cruelty, horror, and all the rest of it comes into being. And also, I don't know why suddenly this comes into my mind at this moment, where food is concerned, man became a hunter in order to obtain his food. He killed creatures. But if you look at Genesis 1:29, and the Lord God said that he gave every herb as food for you, and every fruit of the tree which bears fruit, which has seed in it, and this shall be your food. You look at Genesis 1:29. I can't understand why the vegetarian societies don't quote that in all their things. That's the Lord God. And Sri Krishna in the Gita gives again a marvelous statement about what sort of food is dear to the pure ones, the holy ones. And you know, when as a matter of fact, I've got it in my latest chapter, the food which is good for the pure ones. By chance, I typed out all the different items. These are the foods that are dear to the poor. Well, they are expensive for the poor. Very strange how that slip occurred. Now we come to the last verse. He, the first origin of this creation. Remember that anthropomorphization starts at the very beginning of man's aspirations and so forth. He, the first origin of this creation, whether he formed it all or did not form it, whose eye controls this world in highest heaven, he verily knows it. Or perhaps he knows not. Now that is simply marvelous.